This time on your weekly Constitutional, a subject that sounds neither constitutional nor even interesting, but I promise you, it's both. It's called administrative law.
Administrative law is the law governing how the government, be it the state or federal or local government, how it interacts with us. It's what restricts the government's ability to do as it pleases with us. Administrative law will guide government agencies as to how they interact with the public at large. So administrative law is the law governing how the government agencies deal with us as regulated persons or entities.
That was Akram Pfizer, my friend and colleague at LMU's Law School. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about administrative law and the Constitution.
It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights, produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Some courses in law school just sound interesting, don't they? Criminal law, or maybe torts, or of course, constitutional law. But some courses, not so much. Perhaps chief among them is something called administrative law. Yeah, I find it difficult to say administrative law without yawning in the process. But like many law students who avoided taking that, I regretted it after I left law school because it turned out that administrative law runs all throughout American society. And yep, I ended up spending a lot of time before administrative law judges. Constitutionally speaking, administrative law presents a number of issues, but perhaps chief among them is that it blurs what James Madison called the separation of powers, what's commonly known as checks and balances between the three branches of the national government. This happens at both the state and the national level, and my friend and colleague Akram Pfizer and I frequently talk about it.
Thank you so much, Stuart. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
I must acknowledge the incongruity of us speaking by telephone today because I'm at our studios in Johnson City and you're back at LMU Law School in Knoxville. Normally speaking, you and I speak face-to-face.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm very appreciative for you taking this time out to accommodate me.
Oh, absolutely. And it's my pleasure because, of course, one of our recent conversations involved a subject that you and I have discussed many, many times. And that's the subject of administrative law and how much I hate it.
Yes.
And you teach it. So in some sense, you're more of a supporter of administrative law than I am, aren't you?
Well, if I'm a supporter or not, what I recognize is that I think it's very important to law students, partly because it's not a required course, but so much of what we do involves, as lawyers, interacting with government. I think very few law schools, if any, make it a required course. And most law students will tell you that 5-10 years into their practice, they find the course they wish they had taken in law school, but they didn't take. It was administrative law.
Absolutely. And I will plug your course because I know you do a fine job teaching it because it was exactly my experience. I thought the very subject of administrative law sounded, well, you know, administrative. It sounded really dull. And I wasn't particularly interested in it. I didn't take it. And then lo and behold, when I got into private practice, by the time I got to Florida in the 1990s, probably well over half of my practice was administrative law in some sense. And I think many, many lawyers encounter it, just as you said. So let's start at the beginning. What exactly is this thing we call administrative law?
Administrative law is the law of the government. In other words, it's the law governing how the government, be it the state or federal or local government, how it interacts with us. It's what restricts the government's ability to do as it pleases with us.
And it affects us on a much more regular basis than one would think, because every time we are dealing with some government agency, in all likelihood, we are dealing with administrative law.
Exactly. So the laws we have, administrative law, will guide government agencies as to how they interact with the public at large. So administrative law is the law governing how the government agencies deal with us as regulated persons or entities.
Okay. Let's do another definition. An agency of government, as the name implies, is some sort of bureaucracy, some sort of office staffed with government employees who actually go out and administer the law. So this could be your local branch of the Environmental Protection Agency or the state equivalent. It could be any other agency you deal with, the IRS or the Interior Department.
Exactly.
So these are the bureaucrats, or if you have a particular political persuasion, these are the agents of the deep state who are out there doing their deep state things, right?
Exactly. Or maybe let's now complete Schoolhouse Rock, right? We know how a bill becomes a law.
Right.
Administrative law is now how that law is applied to the citizens and how it regulates our conduct. So basically what typically happens is a law is enacted by Congress, bicamerally through each House of Congress. It's signed into law by the President of the United States. And then the law will set forth and direct various government agencies or bureaucracies now to set up rules or draft rules and then enforce that law against the citizens.
Yes, and that's actually a constitutionally very significant thing, because the first few times Congress tried to do that, the first few times that Congress passed a law and then left a lot of decision-making and a lot of the details to an administrative agency, the Supreme Court of the United States came down with something it called the non-delegation doctrine. And that doctrine basically said, Congress, you cannot give your legislative power away in that fashion. If there are going to be laws, you are going to draft those laws. You are going to pass those laws with the president's concurrence or over his veto. And you can't simply leave it to some agency to fill in the blanks. But that was effectively abandoned back in the 1930s, wasn't it?
Exactly. So in the 1930s, we were on the cusp of this country becoming a superpower, and we were going through the trauma of the Great Depression, which meant that the federal government was going to grow geometrically in size and scope. And what the courts in the early 1930s tried to do was basically restrict Congress's tendency to delegate power to administrative agencies to basically fill the gaps and administer without sufficient input from Congress. And Congress's temptation was understandable, right? They didn't really have that much expertise as to how to, let's say, for example, regulate the transport of oil in interstate commerce, whereas the Interstate Commerce Commission had that expertise. But so the court said, you can't delegate that. What's your responsibility legislatively to do, you can't delegate. However, the courts have ceased enforcing the non-delegation doctrine. And now what is paradigmatic is for Congress to enact, to pass legislation and then instruct agencies to enact what are called legislative rules to enforce the legislation that Congress has just acted.
Right. And the court has been pretty straightforward in the last few years. I recall the Whitman trucking case, I believe it was, where they said that as long as Congress gives enough guidance so that they've enunciated an intelligible principle for the agency to fulfill, that gets them around this non-delegation doctrine, which has never been reversed, but has effectively been hollowed out by the court.
A lot of people are conjecturing that the new Supreme Court that is more conservative, now that Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch have been appointed to the court by President Trump, is going to now resurrect the non-delegation doctrine, because these two conservative judges, the conjecture is, look askance at the administrative state and broad delegations by Congress to administrative agencies. They see them as undemocratic.
Understood. Let's go back again to some basics. The idea of an agency, or if you prefer, bureaucracy, or if you prefer, deep state, the idea there is that the president, who's in charge of seeing that the laws are faithfully executed, simply can't do that by himself. I mean, if you go all the way back to the beginning of the Republic, George Washington, you know, didn't go out and run the Treasury on his own. He appointed Alexander Hamilton to be Secretary of the Treasury, and Alexander Hamilton then hired a staff, and they had their own building, which, by the way, you can go visit in Philadelphia. It's just down the block from Independence Hall. And so there's an agency, and it helps the president to execute the laws. Similarly, there was a Department of State. There was a Department of War, and each of them was headed by a secretary, a cabinet secretary. There's no problem with that. Yet. I mean, we've got these executive agencies executing the law, under the supervision of the president. The problem starts to arise, or at least the issue, the constitutional issue starts to arise, when you have agencies going beyond that simple executive function. And that's what you were talking about, wasn't it, with that rulemaking process?
Exactly. In other words, the typical paradigm that we see when we just read our Constitution, it assumes that Congress will enact the legislation, the president signs it into law, and then the president, completely being silent as to how he would do so, enforces that law. Administrative law basically now assumes the president the Congress has appropriated money for the president to hire bureaucrats to then enforce the law. And because the legislation is threadbare or it's not that detailed, what typically happens is, what's required is, the agencies enact rules that Congress and the public can review, which in turn tell us how the agencies will enforce the law. In other words, the agencies are composed of people to basically do the president's job, because the president only is one person with two arms and two legs.
And so there's always been a question of exactly how a law passed by Congress and signed by the president is going to be put into effect. And so agencies have always had power beyond what one might think they have, simply because, as you say, the laws themselves are somewhat threadbare and they leave a lot of room for interpretation. Well, over the centuries, more and more of this power has devolved upon these agencies until now we actually have a formal process of what we call rulemaking that begins with an announcement of a proposed rule, a period of public comment, maybe even public hearings on the rule, and then eventually adoption of some kind of rule, which is announced in the Code of Federal Regulation to the Federal Register and then eventually codified in the Code of Federal Regulations. And at the end of this lengthy process, these rules have what lawyers call the force and effect of law. Did I get that right?
Absolutely true. They are called legislative rules that regulate us individuals and guide how the agencies will regulate us.
Okay, and that's probably, to my mind, the first major constitutional issue. It's always been lurking there, but now that we've got this formalized procedure, it starts to look more and more and more like an executive agency is legislating. I mean, you've got somebody in the Department of the Treasury going through this lengthy process of coming up with the Treasury rules, and that is outside of Congress entirely.
That is true. I mean, it's very hard for Congress. So typically every year, there are 4,000 rulemakings that are enacted by the various federal bureaucracies. And that would be the Department of Defense, EPA, Interior, right, Treasury, mm-hmm. Health and Human Services, you name it. They all in aggregate come up with about 4,000 rulemakings a year, which is basically more than 10 per day. And that's largely infeasible for Congress to completely review. However, those rulemakings are subjected to some public input. So, for example, what is required is that tentative rules be published in the Federal Register or be published for public input, and then public and regulated entities can then comment on the proposed rules, and the agencies are supposed to take that into consideration, factor that in, respond to the comment, or incorporate the comment before they publish final rules, which are then published, and then Congress can review them, and the broader public can review them, and the broader public, if it feels it's unfairly regulated by them, can seek redress it both via the agency and then in federal court, if in fact agency relief isn't available.
Oh, once the legislature's weary of regulation's vast details, delegates lawmaking powers and the authority that entails. By enabling legislation's passage, an agency the law creates to do the work of regulating and to follow legislative mandates. Yeah, for following legislative mandates. For the agency functions, they are three, like a legislature, executive, and judiciary. Traditional power separation does not apply to this situation. The bureaucracy that permeates the business world in all the states. And you, why you get administrator run around? For a surefire way to speed things up, you gotta get administrative law down.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with my friend and colleague at Lincoln Memorial University's Law School, Akram Pfizer. We're talking about a topic that at first blush seems kind of dry, administrative law. But as we're already figuring out, it has lots and lots of fascinating constitutional implications. Listening to your weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris. Today our subject is administrative law, and specifically how it blurs the distinctions between the three branches of government and perhaps negatively impacts something we call the separation of powers. For our purposes at the moment, it looks awfully like you've got the executive through one of these agencies legislating. And that brings, of course, the constitutional concept of separation of powers, perhaps James Madison's most fundamental contribution to at least the first seven articles of our Constitution, was taking the three basic functions of government, legislation, execution, and adjudication, and putting them in three different branches manned by three different groups of people, and to some extent putting them in conflict with one another to create a system of what we commonly call checks and balances. So that's the first fuzziness that we'll identify today that seems to at first glance, at least, to violate this concept of separation of powers. The next function of government is, of course, execution. And most observers have no problem with an executive agency executing the law. I mean, they've always done that. But you've already alluded to the third power of government, and that's adjudication. Could you talk a little bit about how disputes under enforcement of these rules happens?
What may well happen is a party that the field is being regulated by an agency based on rules that they think are unfair can seek redress. Basically, the agency will commence enforcement through an internal agency adjudication. So all agencies typically have an internal adjudicatory body, in other words, an administrative law judge. So the typical paradigmatic example I'm sure all your listeners would be familiar with is Social Security judges who adjudicate whether an individual is entitled to Social Security disability benefits or not. And that's the typical internal agency adjudication. And after that process is complete and after appeals are exhausted, the regulated party that still feels aggrieved and didn't get satisfaction can file suit in federal court under a very deferential standard of review called arbitrary and capricious or a substantial evidence standard of review that's deferential to the agency, seeking redress in court. Now, problematically for those who question the legality of the administrative state, that is a deferential standard of review, which follows an administrative adjudication that many would say tends to be favorable to the administrative agency as well.
Exactly. I mean, the Constitution contemplates that if the federal government passes a law that hurts me, I get to then go to federal court and file a lawsuit or perhaps go to federal court and defend some sort of action that's been filed against me. And I'll go before an impartial Article III judge who has been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate and who has effectively lifetime tenure. So I can expect a fair shake from that federal judge. But this system is different. This system says that the same agency that made the rule, which again is effectively law, which has enforced the rule against me, now gets to judge whether it has done so appropriately, and not through an Article III judge, but through an administrative law judge who, to a greater or lesser extent, is beholden to the agency itself for his continued employment. Now, there have been some attempts to insulate these judges from retaliation, but I think probably every ALJ knows that if he or she rules against the relevant agency too frequently, that that person's job may be affected. And then even that ruling of the administrative law judge is merely a recommendation in most cases, which then ultimately is going to be decided upon by, you guessed it, the head of the same agency that promulgated the rule and enforced the rule. And so it looks like what James Madison described as the very definition of tyranny, all of the powers of government in a single entity. And I think that's probably what many observers, certainly including me, find very uncomfortable. How do you feel about that?
I think it goes too far to call it tyranny in this, for this very simple reason, is any presidential administration comes in every 48 years, typically 8 years, because most American presidents tend to be reelected. But the bureaucracy, the people staffing the administrative agencies, by and large, the permanent civil service does not change based on the political actors in Washington. And the administrative law judges are people who have job protection, some form of, let's call it, tenure, since you and I are both in academia, and tenure that protects them from adverse employment treatment if they don't necessarily abide completely by the administration in power. So there's some job protection. There's also political culture norms we have to insulate administrative agencies from retaliating against ALJs who hold against them. But I see your point. It's not bulletproof, right? For example, I mean, let's just imagine we're an administrative agency that the person has tenure, they're protected from being let go without cause. But we can conjecture that the ALJ who holds against the agency may get the worst office or the worst secretary compared to his counterpart, right?
Right.
So, I mean, that could well be the case. And I can't really speak to that. What I do know is most ALJs feel they have less job protection than they should have. That's been evidenced in the polling that's been taken anonymously of ALJs in the federal government.
Right, indeed. To take but one example that's currently very much in the news, the immigration judges, who are administrative judges, who work for the federal government, are, according to them and according to their union, being pressured to handle enormous caseloads and to effectively find against the people in front of them most of the time.
Mm-hmm. And that's very unfortunate. That's not how the system should be worked, because the system this is the difficulty we have, is Congress typically, which is composed of 535 people, 435 in the House, 100 in the Senate, does not have the time, the resources, or the expertise to regulate an administrative, a superpower country like the United States. That's just not feasible as Congress is currently composed. So there has to be some delegation, and the agencies are those who should receive that delegation in view of their manifest expertise and the staffing power they have. So, for example, the Affordable Care Act rulemaking delegation to the Health and Human Services Department was legitimated by the fact that HHS has the people on its staff with expertise in healthcare, and it has 85,000 employees within its bureaucracy. So that just gives you an understanding of the scale of the manpower differential between the legislative branch and the administrative agencies.
Okay, well, that's a fair point. So as a practical matter, maybe it's necessary to have some degree of delegation to these agencies filled with agency experts. But you mentioned one other aspect of this whole process, very much at the tail end of it, is that if I go in front of an agency and the agency rules against me based upon rules that it itself has promulgated and has enforced against me, I can appeal or file a lawsuit, an original claim, in federal court. So finally, I'm in front of a real Article III judge who's been nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, who has lifetime tenure. Finally, I'm going to get somebody completely independent of this process. But then, as you alluded to before, there's something called Chevron deference, named after the famous Chevron case. I think it was the early 1980s.
1984, exactly, yes.
1984, which effectively says that the federal court is supposed to defer to all of this expertise of the agency and is only supposed to rule in my favor if I'm fighting the agency, if I meet a very high burden, right?
Exactly. So it was a case called Chevron v. National Resources Defense Council. And in that case, the EPA enacted a regulation that an environmental group challenged because they perceive the interpretation EPA made of the regulation, it was the Reagan administration's EPA, was too generous to the petrochemical company, Chevron in that matter. And they challenged, saying that we should be able to challenge it because we see that their interpretation of the regulation, their regulation is lowers the bite of the statutory enactment. In other words, the statute was intended to be more strict with the petrochemical industry, and the regulation and basically enabled the petrochemical companies to get away with basically more pollutants or emittance on its power generating plants. The reason I say this is the court's decision was, it said that in view of the fact that Congress delegated rulemaking authority to the agency, we should apply and allow those rules to stand so long as they are either, so long as they are permissible. In other words, they could be, the court may have a different interpretation, but it should allow the agency interpretation to apply under a two-part test. The first prong basically says the agency interpretation can stand unless it's unequivocally wrong. But even if it's not unequivocally wrong, it's allowed to stand so long as it's permissible. And the argument from conservatives and many opponents of the administrative state, or what we call administrative overreach, they argue that Chevron deference basically entitles agencies to increase the regulatory ratchet on American citizens and regulated entities beyond the scope of congressional enactments.
Isn't that interesting that conservatives are the ones who are now complaining about Chevron deference, whereas in that case, it was actually an agency being too friendly, allegedly, to the regulated community. So it actually isn't a conservative or liberal issue. It's simply whether you think an agency has too much power or not, one way or the other.
Exactly. And I think that what's hard to basically address in our dispute about things like Chevron deference or the lower levels of deference, and they're called Skidmore or our deference, is how do we maintain an effectively governed country without granting some level of deference to administrative agencies? It's a hard one to basically think through, but it's altogether infeasible for a Congress of 535 people to be effectively regulating a $22 trillion economy and composed of 330 million citizens.
Okay, well, this is the point at which I throw out my radical reform idea that the two of us have discussed and which makes you laugh every time I bring it up. But I'll put it out there and I'll let you ridicule it. My idea is that we abolish this entire system, that we allow agencies to exist. They have to exist. And we allow them to go through a rulemaking process that's virtually identical to the one we have now. But those rules do not become effective until Congress has actually considered them and passed them into law. In other words, fulfilled its legislative function with the advice of the agency, following by which the agency can then enforce those rules if they are in fact enacted. No problem there because agencies are part of the executive. And then finally, if an aggrieved party dislikes something the agency has done, we just eliminate those quasi-judicial ALJs and allow aggrieved parties to file directly in federal court, where there will be some, but significantly less deference given to the agencies. And my proposal will preserve, I think, the separation of powers mandated by our Constitution, and will not necessarily be conservative or liberal, because it will simply be a limitation of powers of agencies generally, whether they're going to be too friendly to the regulated public or too restrictive. But you don't think that that would work, do you?
I just don't think it's feasible. I think it's well-intentioned. I'm sympathetic to where you're coming from, but there are 4,000 rulemakings every year. And I don't see by any standard, the way that number of rulemakings comes down is if we drop multiple rulemakings into one rulemaking, kind of consistent with what the president's recommending in his, you know, 2-for-1 proposals that he's talked about on the hustings, right? I just don't see how that's feasible and how Congress could really be able to work that. I think benevolently motivated as it is, I think the greater risk is what we saw recently involving Boeing, right? Where basically, and the New York Times had a piece on this weekend talking about the recent FAA legislation, right? And it talked about how the recent enactment by Congress basically limited the role of the FAA in regulating the airline industry by basically cutting the FAA out and having Boeing basically enact the legislation, and then had the regulators, in a strange way, be subservient to the industry such that the regulators were not given an ability to review, for example, the flight software that led to the problems of the Boeing MAX 8, and under the FAA legislation that Congress duly enacted, Democrats and Republicans, they did things like they tied FAA employee salaries and performance evaluations to what Boeing thought of the employee.
Oh, my.
And so it was a piece, and I'll be glad to send it to you. It was in the New York Times, October 27th. It said, before the deadly crashes, Boeing pushed for law that undercut oversight. In other words, they basically adopted, and this is the risk when we starve the administrative state, rather than resuscitating democracy as it's currently composed, what we really end up happening, the lunatics start running the asylum. And in this case, it was Boeing basically undercutting legitimate FAA attempts to regulate them, and that was the proximate cause, according to this article, of the accidents in Indonesia and then the accident in Ethiopia that led to the grounding of the MAX 8.
And that's tragic, and it does seem like the agency didn't do its job there, or at least Congress didn't do its job in terms of directing the agency. But does my proposal necessarily lead to that? I'm not arguing that we starve the administrative agencies. I'm arguing we let them do their job with the sole caveat that Congress actually has to agree to what now is just a final rulemaking. Congress would actually have to enact it into law.
And your proposal makes perfect sense. I would just say that there's a proposal that's enacted. There's legislation that basically gives Congress right now the vote to disapprove of a regulation that it disagrees with. And that has to go through bicameralism and presentment. That's only happened once, and that was involving an OSHA regulation that went into effect at the tail end of the Clinton administration and then was invalidated when the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, took office. There's also been what's called the RAINS, which basically proposes doing what you recommend. It's not been enacted into law. And I think the difficulty is, the reality is, I don't know, and I struggle with this, I just don't see how Congress has the resources to keep up with that obligation.
Okay, I think, and that's a valid practical concern. Let's go to the other end of the process then, because my other objection is that these agencies do their own adjudications about their own rules, about their own officials. Would there be a problem in simply taking the money that we currently spend on administrative law judges and creating a few more United States District Court judges and making them go through the confirmation process and giving them lifetime tenure, and then taking these quasi-judicial administrative proceedings and making them real judicial proceedings? That would preserve at least some separation of powers. Is there a problem that you see with that?
I don't necessarily see it that way, except I remember what an American federal judge is a generalist, right? A generalist, a highly intelligent generalist, is an American district court judge. And it could well be the case that your typical generalist lawyer doesn't have or benefits from the administrative expertise of the administrative adjudicatory system that helps inform the federal district court before it makes its post-administrative review adjudication under the deferential review standard we talked about. So that I see your point, and we do that quite effectively sometimes, but see how difficult a standard it is. So, for example, we have your system when it comes to the Federal Trade Commission adjudication, the most famous one being the Microsoft case, right? Mm-hmm. That didn't go through administrative adjudication. And an adjudication was brought by the federal government. They hired the great super lawyer David Boies to bring suit claiming that Microsoft violated the Sherman Antitrust Act when it brought in in its dealings with Netscape Navigator, when it brought in the Internet Explorer browser and put it in gratis with its computer software.
Oh my goodness, you're dating yourself, Akram. I remember Netscape Navigator, and I remember this controversy.
Exactly, and that was brought by there was no administrative adjudication at all. It was a federal court proceeding brought in federal district court, which is how it's done when we try to vindicate the FTC, right, or protect against unfair competition under the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Mm-hmm.
That starts with an adjudication. The problem with that, as we know, though, is we see how few antitrust adjudications that have been brought, right? And we can all concede, you and I will concede here, when you don't have administrative adjudication commenced by an administrative enforcement, the dearth of adjudications which are commenced in court evidences the government is disinclined to bring those for lack of resources, typically. And we know since that Microsoft case was adjudicated in favor of the government, how many things, like, let's say, airline mergers that really should have been stopped by the government have been allowed to proceed, right? And so this is the thing. We may think we're going to get adequate administrative oversight under a lawsuit system which commences in federal court, but the most likely scenario, in view of the scarcity of judicial resources and the government's reluctance to commence matters, by way of example, through the Justice Department, and the political tendency to avoid commencing adjudication through the Justice Department, is we're most likely going to have under enforcement of federal and state regulations by adopting your proposal.
Now, I can see that argument. On the other hand, if all it is a matter of resources, then I would counter that's the solution. Not only do we create more federal judges and build more federal courthouses, that we adequately fund them. In fact, that brings up a whole other issue about adequate funding of our justice system, which is a drop in the federal budget and which is woefully underfunded already. So I'll concede that point, that we need more judicial resources, and this proposal would require even greater judicial resources. But that, I think, is something that could be done with a proper political will. At any rate, that's my, as we've discussed many times, my relatively radical overhaul proposal that I believe would be policy neutral but would be constitutionally very sound. But you've got some other ideas that are perhaps not so radical. And in fact, you've written a brand new law review article that's going to be published at the Tennessee Journal of Law and Policy?
Yes, it is. And, you know, thanks to you, I actually, it's titled effectively about resurrecting Congress to prevent administrative overreach.
Oh, my. And that's a really good title. That's right. I gave you that. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. One of the reasons we perceive we have administrative overreach is, I think, for a country of our size and power, we have a relatively understaffed legislative branch. So we have only 435 members of the House of Representatives and 100 senators. That basically means we have one representative for every 750,000 Americans. Now, the Constitution allows us to increase representation such that we can have one representative per 30,000 inhabitants. But we, for whatever reason, have stopped increasing the size of Congress, which we did at the start of the Republic, starting in 1929 with the Reapportionment Act signed into law by President Hoover. Why we've stopped at that, I don't know. But for whatever reason, since basically on the cusp of the growth of the federal government, we artificially limited the size of Congress to only 435, which makes us one of the least effectively represented populations in the world. We have basically one representative for every 750,000 or so Americans, while the typical average in other countries is about one for every 200,000 to 300,000 people. So that's a huge problem. It basically means that our representatives have much, much bigger constituencies, and that in conjunction with the fact they are responsible for their own fundraising, and they have a biennial election cycle as opposed to one every 4 to 5 years in parliamentary democracies, makes it altogether infeasible for them to basically keep up with constituency obligations, fund their reelections, and then also, in a country of 330 million people, effectively oversee and legislate for an administrative bureaucracies, right? So I think what I recommend is tripling the size of the House of Representatives so that our representation rate is consistent with other mature democracies, one for every 250,000 or so people.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. My guest this week is my friend and colleague, Akram Pfizer. And he's got some pretty aggressive proposals for dealing with the administrative state and its impact on our Constitution. And now let's finish our discussion with my friend and colleague Akram Pfizer from LMU's Law School, who's got some very interesting proposals on how to fix the problems with the administrative state. They all kind of boil down to one thing. Let's make Congress more powerful and much bigger. We currently have 335 Congress members.
435 representatives and 100 senators.
Right.
Of course, my proposal does not affect the Senate, and that's
right.
Because the Constitution precludes that. It's one provision in our Constitution that can't be amended, which is equal suffrage in the Senate at 2 per senator. But my recommendation is to triple the size of the House of Representatives so that we have about 1,250 members of the House with a minimum of 3 per state, such that states like Vermont, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming that currently just have one representative will have automatically 3.
Okay, and how is this going to help the administrative state in reducing administrative overreach?
My view is just increasing the size will enable for division of labor and potential mastery of subject matter by allowing for representatives to basically have, in other words, you have more hands on deck to deal with the issues. So it'll enable for greater levels of sophistication than currently is the case. But the second prong of my proposal is to change the way we elect representatives from the current single-member plurality system that we use here in the United States, but is also used in Canada and the United Kingdom, to a proportional representation system such as is used in Germany and Scandinavia, so that we don't suffer the baneful effects of gerrymandering and partisan districting that basically enables, that predetermines election outcomes and basically undermines effective legislative drafting. And so my view is if we change those two things, we can have a bipartisan approach to administrative oversight and legislation that I think could allow for better lawmaking, better administrative oversight, and at the end of the day, a more effectively governed country. Because I think we're needlessly hamstringing Congress's ability to legislate for and oversee the administrative state by undermining by artificially limiting its size and then undermining their abilities to be elected or for bipartisan compromise by the means of by artificially allowing for the continuance of single-member plurality districting.
That's actually why I suggested the title of your paper, because after I had fully explored these issues during our discussions, I realized that that's really what you're talking about. We've already discussed the fact that our federal judicial system is woefully understaffed and underfunded. Now, Congress is too. And as you point out, we simply stopped increasing it and stopped increasing its budget proportionately. And simultaneously, we've been enormously increasing the size and the power of the executive.
Exactly.
So we've got these three branches, and two of them we have been starving.
Exactly.
Well, I know, just as I did, when people hear that you want to increase or triple the size of the House of Representatives, their first reaction might be a visceral one. Well, you know, why do we need that? We don't need more politicians. But you know, as you point out, many hands make light work. And if, you know, properly run, the House of Representatives would have perhaps more committees with more specific responsibilities. People could specialize more, and they could more effectively oversee the agencies that they were charged with overseeing. In fact, that's an important part of Congress's job that we're seeing right now happening, that is oversight. These Congress, and through its committee system typically, will have an agency or two that is overseen by a particular committee. And those committees will be very conversant with what's going on there. They will be very conversant with at least the important rules. They're in the process of going through those agencies. And they will question those agency people and hold the power of the purse over them. And I've actually seen this in action myself. My very first job out of law school was when I was in the Army. I worked for the chief counsel of the Army Corps of Engineers, the biggest contractor in the world, and or if you want to think of it cynically, the biggest producer of government pork in the United States. Huge budgets and huge projects that affected just about every corner of the United States. And the Natural Resources Committees of both houses of Congress, the Energy and Environment Committees, they oversaw us And believe me, whenever we got an inquiry from a member of one of those committees over at the Army Corps of Engineers, it was marked with a red tab and it got action. So congressional oversight is a powerful tool. But now, perhaps, with the restriction on the number of members of Congress, you just don't have enough members of Congress able to focus on one particular area. They've got too many committee assignments. They've got too many responsibilities. And so a lot of things fall through the cracks. Is that essentially what you're arguing?
Exactly. And then add in conjunction to that how they're elected. So let's take an example we can all agree is applicable to American life and our polarized political culture. And that is the Affordable Care Act enacted by President Obama. What we forget, though, is the Affordable Care Act really is the successor to Romney Care, which was enacted, signed into law by the Republican former governor of Massachusetts, who was, of course, President Obama's opponent in the 2012 general election. And it was adopted at the federal level for this reason. It was seen that Romney Care was working, but the problem in Massachusetts was it was leading to an adverse selection problem. In other words, Massachusetts was losing taxpayers who didn't like paying the individual mandate and gaining indigents from neighboring states, which was undermining the viability. So the Congress, when it came in 2008, was a largely Democratic Congress. But this is the problem. It was enacted after the perception that the Iraq War was a failure, as well as the perception that the Bush administration did a parlous job in addressing the crisis that was Hurricane Katrina. And therefore, based on the 2006 and 2008 wave elections, there was an artificial surplus of Democratic congressmen who came into office starting in 2009. It was 257 Democrats compared to 194 or something Republicans, or 196 Republicans. And based on that, notice though, on a single member plurality, the first Republicans to lose their seats would have been the moderate Republicans in the swing districts, which meant after those two wave elections, we had basically a supermajority of Democrats and only the diehard red state Republicans remaining who refused to work with Democrats because they basically felt they were disinclined as partisans, and also they knew that any assistance they gave the Democrats would risk them being challenged in the primary in the subsequent election cycle. As a result, it was entirely written by Speaker Pelosi with the help of people at HHS and the Obama White House, with very little, if any, Republican assistance at all. And that, in turn, facilitated the characterization of the legislation as a partisan piece of legislation, and this was the Republican talking point, that was shoved down the throats of the American public, when indeed it was largely piggybacked off Romney Care in Massachusetts, which was a Republican enactment.
Yeah.
Now, this is the key thing. If we had adopted proportional representation as well as a larger house, notice, for example, some of the mistakes that happened in the drafting process, and my article talks about some of the drafting mistakes that led to the loss of support for the legislation, could well have been avoided. But two is, notice, if indeed we had a different form of electing representatives, right, then indeed it wouldn't have been characterized as partisan and something that was shoved down the throats, but it would have been seen as a legitimate bipartisan approach to enacting legislation, because most likely if we had proportional representation, there would have been many Republicans who would have had a seat at the table or would have cooperated with Speaker Pelosi. And let's be honest, if the Republican concerns had been presented, it would have been a better piece of legislation. And one of the great infirmities of the legislation is, I think, neither President Obama nor Speaker Pelosi or the other members of the congressional leadership at the time in 2009 and 10 ever anticipated any state rejecting the Medicare expansion funds under the Affordable Care Act. But that has been paradigmatic in red states, which has undermined the viability of the law. And my guess is, if they had had Republicans, if they had included Republicans, or Republicans had been elected who would have had a seat at the table, they might have properly advised or enabled for the legislation to anticipate that outcome.
Or maybe even to avoid it, if it avoided the perception of extreme partisanship.
Exactly.
Let's put it in concrete terms. I lived for a number of years in the wonderful Commonwealth of Virginia. And since we elect single-member districts, we divide the state up, as most states do, into single-member districts, and there's a winner-take-all. Well, then either you're in a red district or a blue district. And given the fact that there are primaries and that the most ardent partisans tend to participate in the primaries, you have deep red district or, very dark red districts and very deep blue districts. Whereas if you went with a proportional system and you no longer had geographical lines dividing up districts, you simply said to all the voters of the Commonwealth of Virginia, here's a slate of candidates from the Republicans. Here's a slate of candidates from the Democrats. You pick your favorite 12 or how many districts, or how many representatives you have in your state. And then the highest 12 vote getters are going to be the representatives. You'd end up with a much more purple congressional delegation than you would one that was divided along blue and red lines.
Absolutely true. Exactly.
And then in turn, that would lead to more cooperation in Congress generally. And to bring it back to your thesis, it would also allow a more nonpartisan review of these agency rules and would grease the skids, if you would, to allow Congress to do more of its oversight job.
Exactly. And if that happens, in other words, we have a better staffed Congress that's more appropriately elected in view of, how the information we have available to us, that is more bipartisan inclined, that is more willing to work with the other side. Notice a lot of the problems, like weak legislative drafting, like failures in administrative oversight, or the reflexive partisan approach to administrative oversight, all that plausibly would disappear. And what we now characterize as infirmities of the administrative state would potentially go away, right? Because in many ways, what's happened is our inability to legislate has led inexorably to a perceived administrative oversight. Because what happens, because legislation doesn't happen, is things like executive orders or administrative rulemakings are being used as means of bypassing the inflexible, polarized, and stalled legislative process. The obvious example, like I outlined in my article, is the example involving the immigration deferred action executive order that President Obama instituted and now President Trump is trying to reverse, right?
DACA.
That was only done largely because for over a generation, basically since 1986, the Congress has been unwilling to recognize that the Mexican border has become a world migratory route of people from Central and South America into this country for work reasons. And Congress has refused to acknowledge the basic 11 million unauthorized or illegal immigrants living in the country and has been unwilling to address their unlawful presence. And the president finally, after congressional immobility on the issue, enacted, though, an executive order. Now, I would stipulate that executive order had some constitutional infirmities. For example, granting government benefits to people outside of statutory authorization, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, isn't it very likely that if you had a bigger-sized, bipartisan-inclined Congress, that immobility would never have prompted an executive overreach?
Very possible. And we're running out of time, but I must say that my initial reaction to your proposals was to look at them somewhat askance and not really understand how they might fix this problem. But now that I understand that this would ultimately resurrect this first branch of government and would make it more co-equal with the executive, maybe there is something to it. So we'll be following what happens with your article and expecting legislation to be proposed soon to enact it.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Stuart. It's really good of you.
One last question, Akram. If we increase Congress to over 1,200 members, where do we put them all?
I think there could easily be space found for them. And it's not beyond the capacity of the United States to build a new building.
We could add some more offices on the inside of the dome. Maybe cut a few windows there. We could do something like that. Well, Akram Pfizer of Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law, thank you, as always, for your enlightening conversation.
You're very kind. It was a pleasure, Stuart. Have a lovely day.
And that's our show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.